From the KTOO Newsroom in Juneau, I'm Yvonne Cremery. Alaska Native language experts share their personal stories at the state capitol on Friday. They were there to give an update on the Alaska Native Language Preservation and Advisory Council. As KNBA's Rhonda McBride reports, they also hope to inspire those at the highest level of government to support Indigenous languages.
Dr. Waukee Charles told a gathering of lawmakers and their staffers that at the age of 12, he was taken away from his home in Amonok and sent to a boarding school. He said his mother only spoke the Yupik language, or Yuktun, and didn't understand what happened to him.
My mother, just recently, she died 9 years ago, finally told me that every time she heard a plane approaching to our village, that once a week, she was hoping I would be in that plane returning home, but I never did.
Charles said he was also ripped away from his heart language and didn't reconnect to it until he was in college. 2 years ago, Charles became the first Native director of the Alaska Native Language Center at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Yayuk Bernadette Alvana Stimful, an Inupiaq language leader, recalled what she felt as a child.
I could remember being a non-English speaker at 5 years old, making us to sing this song, "I'm a little teapot, short and stout." In my five-year-old Inupiaq mind, say niungilanga, I am not a teapot.
So Alaska for a long time had been on a path of decided elimination of Indigenous languages. Right? There was intention, there was purpose, there was a well-orchestrated attack on our peoples.
Hune Lance Twitchell told the group that there are 23 Alaska Native languages, and a few of those are no longer spoken.
We don't like the word extinct. We prefer dormant, because we've seen languages come back.
Hune says with only 30 fluent speakers of Tlingit, it hasn't been easy to rescue his language, but it is possible.
Imagine if you could, if the English language went three generations without creating a single new speaker. Then imagine if you could, watching a child sit down at a table full of elders who could then speak to that child, and that child understands them.
Hune says those elders had lived through a 70-year gap without hearing any new speakers of their language.
We didn't tell her to. She just went and sat with the elders. And they were laughing, and I could just see the sparkle in their eyes to see a child who can understand them.
In his work as head of the Native Language Program at the University of Alaska Southeast, Hune has helped to create a new generation of Tlingit speakers. He says those who work at the state capitol also have an important part to play.
Everybody who works in this building for the people, that when you walk through those doors every day, maybe you could just give yourself an affirmation. And that affirmation is this: no language dies on my watch. No language dies on my watch.
And the legislature definitely bears some responsibility in this, because back in 2012, it created the Language Preservation Council that Hune now chairs. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
As Alaska wildfire seasons grow more intense, access to air quality data is crucial for communities trying to limit smoke exposure. But in most of rural Alaska, that data is sparse or difficult to access. A UAA environmental health professor is hoping to change that. Alaska Public Media's Kavitha George reports.
Dr. Micah Hahn knows that when it comes to climate resilience, that is, preparing and adapting for the impacts of climate change like worsening wildfires, communities need data.
And right now, most communities in Alaska don't have access to that real-time information to know, how bad is it outside? Should I go to fish camp? Should I go collect berries right now? Or should I maybe wait till tomorrow when the smoke is better? People can't make even basic daily decisions because they don't have access to that information.
Hahn recently secured an EPA grant to work with scientists and individual communities to build an online tool to monitor climate hazards like smoke and track community health across the state. She's hoping it will give rural communities a better picture of how wildfires are affecting them over time by following, for example, asthma prevalence, mental health, or ecological health impacts. Han is also hoping that having easy access to data will help communities get more climate resilience funding.
And for them to be able to easily go to a data set where they can, you know, make a map of their community or pull out some historical fire information and say, this has been a problem in our community and it's projected to be a problem in the future. As a result, we were requesting funding for X, Y, and Z.
But in order to present this kind of data in a tool, Han needs monitors to collect it. That's where the State Department of Environmental Conservation comes in. They're working to expand the air quality monitoring network into rural Alaska. The state maintains EPA standard air quality monitoring in Anchorage, the Mat-Su, Fairbanks, and Juneau. But air quality can vary widely, and monitoring elsewhere in the state is patchy. DEC has set up about 15 monitors in coastal rural communities over the last few years, and they're waiting on funding from a separate EPA grant to build out a statewide network of about 40 rural monitors. Taylor Borgfeld is project lead for the rollout. She says the department can't order more monitors until they get their funding, so it's unlikely to be completed before this year's fire season.
Whether or not we're going to see that equipment this summer and a meaningful time to get much deployed is kind of a big question mark at this point. So within the next year and a couple months, we're trying to get as many, if not all of them, deployed.
Han is still in the planning phases of her project, working with rural communities to understand what they want out of an air quality monitoring tool. She's hoping as DEC rolls out more monitors and the available data becomes more robust, her team will have an interactive tool online in the next 4 years. In Anchorage, I'm Kavitha George.
About 28% of registered Anchorage voters cast a ballot in the spring election. It's the lowest voter turnout since the city moved to by-mail voting. But as Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early reports, election officials say it's still higher than in the years before the change.
Historically, Anchorage voter turnout has been all over the place. The highest years were in the 80s. Three elections had more than 50% turnout. Then by 2010, turnout plummeted to less than 20%. And Municipal Clerk Barbara Jones says local politicos started taking notice.
In 2015 and 16, former Assembly Member Ernie Hall was concerned about voter turnout, and he asked the clerk's office to look into what we could do to increase voter turnout.
Enter mail-in elections. After multiple public meetings, the city made the switch as a way to boost turnout. The first by-mail election was held in 2018, and turnout topped 36%, the highest in 20 years. Every year since has had turnout above 25%, including this year, a non-mayoral election.
I do think that voter turnout has increased, so Ernie Hall's experiment was successful.
Election officials say vote by mail is not only better for turnout, but relies on fewer staff, provides more flexibility for voters, and ends up being cheaper. Elections clerk Jamie Hines says the first by-mail election in 2010 did cost double as the city acquired a new election center and equipment to scan and tabulate votes. But now the price has dropped significantly.
So now that we are using that over and over and year over year over year, the costs are going down. The cost per voter is less.
Before mail-in voting, the city's cost per voter was between $9 and $11. Now the figure is down to just under $8. The number of election staff required is also way smaller, down from 600 to 60. Still, the mail-in system is not without its detractors. Some question how secure the system is, with some voters reporting that they've received other people's ballots in the mail. Hines says even if somebody does try to vote with another person's ballot, there are parameters in place to prevent it from being counted.
What stops it from being counted is that that signature isn't going to match. We get 5 signatures from the state, and we have a team of 5 people who do signature verification. They're trained by forensic document examiners, and they're trained to look for characteristics of signatures.
Hines says there could also be criminal consequences if someone tries voting with someone else's ballot.
There were, I think, 6 situations, and APD did go knock on their doors. And we think most of the time it was a clear misunderstanding of the laws, but I think they understand it quite well now.
Jones invites residents who may be skeptical about the mail-in process to come to the downtown voting center. If they can't make it, there's a 24-hour live stream during elections. In Anchorage, I'm Wesley Early.
And as for the weather here in Juneau, it's currently 40 degrees and raining. The low tonight is 41, and tomorrow the high is 50 degrees, but it's also still going to be raining. Saturday, we might get some sun with a high of 60 degrees. You're listening to KTOO.